Opa!
Cut. Cut. Oh,
no. I can keep going. Why do you cut me off? I can keep doing this. Okay.
That was pretty good.
I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
Oh, Lizzie, buddy. What are we again? We're a podcast and we talk about some medical stuff, sometimes not medical stuff. Is that correct?
True.
Okay. Another question for you.
Yeah.
What is cold and delicious and wonderful and something we're going to talk about right now?
I think it's not beer.
That's true. It is cold and delicious. But what's cold but really delicious? Because is beer really delicious or did we learn to love it?
Yeah, it's an acquired taste. I agree. You're right. What you're getting at is ice cream. And I think that everyone agrees that that's delicious from day one.
Yes. I mean, everyone's into ice cream. And we're going to talk about ice cream. You know why we're going to talk about ice cream?
Because you got some free ice cream.
Well, not just that, but because, you know, during the quarantine, I've been doing my part to create jobs. I'm a job creator
by eating ice cream.
I'm trying to support my local economy by trying as many different local San Francisco ice creameries as possible. And I think I've done a pretty good job at this point. So I kind of wanted to talk to you about what I feel are the best ice creams and come up with a definitive list of the top three ice creams in San Francisco that are specific to, you know, locally here in San Francisco. So are you ready for this?
I am, but I'm going to say I'm going to post a photo or have you post a photo of my freezer, which has probably 6 to 8 different little pints of ice cream because throughout all the last couple of years, anything I've hosted, mostly outdoor events and, little pod events, people bring ice cream. And apparently Tyler and I do not eat that much ice cream. So we just accumulate it. I like it in the moment. I don't crave it, especially in San Francisco. It's not like we rarely get like those 90 degree humid hot days. So I've been accumulating them. So I know all the local ice cream places.
Let me ask you this. What is your, in general, favorite flavor of ice cream?
I would probably reach for like a mint chip or a salted caramel. Those are like,
you are like a 90-year-old Jewish lady at heart.
Yeah. Yeah. Always been, always has been, always will be. I'm not a chocolate person. I would take vanilla any day over chocolate. Chocolate can go fuck itself. That was very controversial.
That's a hot take. No, I think it's great. We need some of that controversy on the show. That's good stuff.
I know.
I also agree. I will not enjoy like straight up chocolate. There's like that part of my brain that just, some people just love like a piece of chocolate. I won't do it.
No, you need a little like touch of peanut butter or something.
Right. I don't like straight up chocolate. Just can't. Like a chocolate bar does nothing for me. How are you on cookies and cream?
I like it. I mean, honestly, most ice creams I'm good with. There's some weird stuff. Someone once brought like a Thanksgiving ice cream to work and it was like a turkey umami meaty thing. And I'm like, tastes delicious, but I still want to puke. You know, like there are things that you can do that are fucked up with ice cream.
It's just, the point is lost. I mean, for me, I'm not a purist or anything, but you know, there's certain things that are lost on me. Like I love coffee and I love ice cream, but coffee flavored ice cream just makes me mad.
I agree. Like, doesn't work for me. Yeah.
What's the point? If I wanted coffee, I'd be drinking a nice warm hot cup of coffee.
Right. Oh my God. You should let's try to nuke mocha ice cream and see if we like it. Like make it hot.
Tastes good. That's a great idea. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, so what's your top three list in San Francisco?
I have a love hate with Mitchell's. I love the ice cream, but my car got broken into in that parking lot. So it's hard for me to actually enjoy that. Mm-hmm. But that's definitely a good one. Then there's Smitten, there's Byright. And then there's that one in the Ferry Building, Humphrey Slocum, which has like these funky flavors that, you know, there's so many good ones. I have to say I'm not an aficionado. So I would definitely defer to you if you're like really trying to eat ice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're trying to eat the ice cream to like help San Francisco survive. And I appreciate it. And we thank you.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us?
We're all doing our part. I know. Yeah. It's just that I'm doing more than most.
Yeah.
And I'll rate them to you. There's so many good options. And I know we're going to get people like saying, well, what about blank? But, you know, here is my list and my list is right. At number 3 on the list is It's It. Now, you probably didn't see that one coming, but It's It, the sandwich with like the two oatmeal cookies and like the usually vanilla, but it can also be mint or it can be chocolate, covered in like a chocolate coating. It's like a classic old school San Francisco treat. They don't have them in many other places. It's like, I think the inventor of the ice cream sandwich, I don't know if anyone's ever done it before that. That solid, like great memories. And I hope my kids will have those great memories too of that. So yeah. That makes it for nostalgia purposes.
Okay. I've never heard of it.
Number two is Mitchell's. Mitchell's ice cream. If you're in San Francisco, guys, check out Mitchell's ice cream. It's so good. Super creamy. And their cookies and cream is, I think, probably the best cookies and cream I've ever had. Okay. Now, just edging them out is Bite Creamery. And Bite Creamery wins for a couple of reasons. One, because they sent us free ice cream.
Nailed it.
And as doctors, the reason we don't take pens from pharmaceutical companies is because we can clearly be influenced. And that's what happened here.
100%.
But to be fair, their ice cream is super delicious. And it's like all locally sourced. It's like organic whenever possible. It's really interesting. They do your classic stuff. And they use seasonal ingredients for like fun, like hip stuff. Yeah. So they sent us a couple of pints. So
the salted caramel was yummy. It was my favorite.
It's right up
there. I like the Earl Grey tea one. I didn't really like the maple.
So the Earl Grey tea one was a lot better than it had any right to be. Because why would you?
I was like, I'm going to hate this. And I really liked it.
Yeah, it's not bad, right? The other one, like the maple oat crunch, that's a non-dairy one. Pretty good for non-dairy though.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't like it.
Yeah, that salted caramel, so good too, that you didn't get to try because I didn't give them to you.
You didn't give them to me?
No, because one's called orange cardamom, which, like, again, I'm like a straightforward cookies and cream, simple flavor kind of guy, and I didn't think I would like it, but it was delicious. Delicious. Smoothie, light, creamy. Oh, all
I
that
wish
stuff.
You had saved me some. Thanks.
I'm sorry. There's still some. I got some for you.
Whatever.
And then the chocolate with Gutaud chocolate. I don't know what Gutaud chocolate is.
You sound like you're trying to not say retard.
Gutaud. Yeah. Gutaud. Anyways, so good. Thank you, Bite Creamery, for that deliciousness. You probably would have made at least top two anyways, but you clearly took home the gold because you sent us free ice cream. Let that be a lesson for you people out there. Right. Send us free stuff and we will show for you.
House of Pod, if you want our love, just give us free shit.
Was really good though. Anyways.
Super good.
Speaking of really good, we have a guest. We have Mary Roach. She is one of our favorite authors, is she not?
She is. I love her.
I'm very excited to have her back. As always, follow us on Twitter at The House of Pod. And if you haven't already, please leave a review for us at iTunes if you're so inclined to write things through the internet. And thank you to Nadim for helping get these episodes out to everyone. Anyone else you want to thank, Lizzie?
Never.
Stay tuned. And welcome back. Today, we are very excited to have back on the show with us, Mary Roach. She writes the best, in my estimation, science books around. They're the most fun. Last time you were on, we talked about writing about subjects that are taboo. We talked about your books that range from cadavers to the GI system to the science of war. First off, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And tell us, how have you been in this last crazy 12 months since we last spoke to you?
Yeah, a little bored. I miss reporting and traveling. The timing was pretty good for me in that I wasn't in the research phase of a book. I was kind of finishing it up and doing all the loose end stuff, and so that was easy to do from home. So I got lucky in that sense, and I've been healthy, and so has my husband and my family. I can't complain.
You can always complain.
You can. We welcome it here, especially on our show.
Being a writer who focuses on science, do you find it tempting to write about COVID, or are you fighting that temptation to write a book about COVID, or are you just thinking at this point it's going to be covered by different people? Is there an angle that you would take to write about it?
No, I'm not tempted to write about COVID, partly because, you know me, COVID is kind of so serious and so huge and so important. Mary Roach isn't the person you call for that.
I don't know. I would love to hear your take on it.
I'm the bottom feeder. You know, I'm the one covering the stuff nobody else wants to cover. I mean, there's so many books on COVID. I'm right now reading a galley for a book, you know, a galley proofs.
Sure.
For a book about the history and future of quarantine, which is so interesting. It's by Nicole Twiley, a New Yorker writer. And the book is coming. I mean, they've been working, she and her husband, writing it together, and they've been working on it for like 7 years, and it just happens to be coming out
right
like in a few months, which, you know, is excellent timing for the topic. But just a really interesting, fascinating angle on it, like that, you know, they found a sort of a way into it that touches on a lot of aspects of COVID and on, you know, and pandemic, but they found their own take on it.
Well, that's an interesting thing that you say, like bottom feeder. And you know, that you're not so serious. I think that's not true. That's very sweet and self-deprecating of you to say, but I think it's, your books do have humor and do have lightheartedness, and that's why they make science so readable and so fun. And would you agree that some of your stuff also has like a historical perspective, and we're in COVID, and you know, with COVID, there is no history yet. So maybe in 5 years, you'll give us a great tale of kind of the tale of COVID.
Yeah, who knows? You know, I'm also, the other thing with COVID is, or the other thing with my kind of reporting is I love to be on the scene reporting in the moment. Right. And there are historical chapters in my books, that's true, all of them. But I really enjoy being in the scene, talking with people, seeing what they're doing. And of course, with COVID, I can't travel. B, it's not safe. So you probably won't see a COVID book.
Let me ask
there'll be lots of other books on COVID, but probably not one for me.
Yeah.
So there's other books about COVID. I never understood how people can get books out so quickly, because I know, like, for example, when you're writing a book, and we talk to Jen Gunter when she writes books, and we have authors on, they spend years working on these books. So like when these books are coming out on COVID, like now, or even earlier than this, like I always assume that it's impossible that they can be useful. I just don't see how they could. I mean, is that sort of looked down upon in the world of authors? I mean, like, how are these guys generally all, I mean, I'm sure you don't want to say anything ill of your fellow authors, but like, it's kind of a hack move, right? Because how can you write a book about COVID so quickly into it while we're still gathering data on it?
Yeah, it is kind of a mystery to me, because the lead time has gotten, in fact, longer over the years. I mean, my first book, I think it was a 9-month lead time from when I turned it into when it came out. Now it's at least a year. The sales people try to get in gear, do pre-sales. I mean, it's happening with such a long lead time. So there's some sort of fast track process for books that I don't know how they're able to do that. I mean, you see things coming out in 2 or 3 months, and I can only imagine that there are people who have all the info. I don't know. I have no idea how.
Yeah.
Yeah. Utterly bizarre.
We do podcasts on it, and like 1 week to the next week, things would change dramatically.
Right.
So I don't know how you could write a book that's in any way definitive or helpful on the subject.
It must be like, you know, how music has changed so much. And when you read who wrote the songs, it's like 20 people sometimes. And maybe that's how books are now. Maybe these books that are churned out so quickly, maybe it's such a big collaborative effort. And I'm not necessarily judging it. I do think it probably loses a voice and maybe a charm that we all appreciate clearly.
Yeah.
But it has to be a huge collaborative effort, right?
Yeah, I really don't know how it's done, and I can't say that I read many of the books. They're often like a, you know, a tell-all on some sort of famous person, something that's happening in politics or right, celebrity culture that is just cranked out. And I think there are kind of, I think that's where probably some sort of ghostwriter, and the word hack might
But it's also, it's a fad too. I mean, I think there's been 100 books about Trump, to your point, in the last 4 years. Like, it just, yeah. It's not necessarily possible. I don't know that these are firsthand accounts of anything.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Those books, the tell-all type of book, the book that's rushed into print like that, often is one that can get you into legal hot water. There has to be for a book like that, I think a strong sense that we are going to sell so many copies that we will be able to afford the lawyers,
right.
The lawsuit. It's worth it to us as a publisher to get, you know, the pants suit off of us because so many people are going to buy this book. Just get it out there.
It almost sounds like you're joking, but I bet you that's totally accurate.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there's super sad. Analysis of how much it's going to cost them. Yeah, I'm
absolutely,
sure.
There is. I think that is realistically. I mean, my books are vetted by a lawyer, and I believe I heard that from her that's kind of the way, you know, the calculus works.
So when you're reading like books that come out, whether it's about like some politician or some tell-all, what do you look for that tells you the author's done their work, their research? I mean, it's easy when I read books that you write, like Gulp, for example, about the GI system. It's easy for me to check it, and it's good, and that's why it's one of the reasons why I trust you so much as a writer, is because I know I double checked it with my own experience and my own knowledge, and Lizzie's, for example, but. When it's a subject that you may not know so much about, what do you go through in your mind to gauge whether or not the person knows what they're doing?
I think it's really hard, and I tend to distrust a book, a nonfiction book on a topic, unless I know who the author is and what their background is, and that they have some experience and or authority, because I know that books aren't fact-checked. I know how many of them are full of just misinformation, not intentional, but just things that, I mean, even with a newspaper, there's every story probably has a mistake in it. I mean, the New Yorker has fact checkers, but fact checkers take a long time. It takes a long time to fact check a book. You know, I have a fact checker on my more recent books, and it's a time consuming process. Anyway, so the bottom line is if it's a writer I know their background and I trust them, then I feel pretty comfortable with it. But it's very disconcerting. You read a book and you stumble onto something that you know is wrong, and then you go like, the whole thing,
how
I just
trust anything?
Do I,
yeah,
just like, how do I know anything was right in here?
So as Kaveh mentioned in the intro, you're an expert, as we would say, in like all things taboo. You know, the book Gulp is famously about the digestion and poop, you know, one of mine and Kaveh's favorite topics. You know, you talk about sex and war and rectal cancer. And we talked on our episode with you a couple of years ago about anal cancer, how we just need to talk about these things, you know? So now I would consider you an expert in these things, maybe not all things, but in this day and age, is there anything that's still taboo? Is there anything you crave to talk about, or that we need to talk about more?
Is there anything that we need to talk? I mean, I think that we as a culture have gotten a lot better at addressing the taboo topics. You know, I mean, I think race is a huge taboo, and that's been talked about a lot this past year, and that's been good, disturbing, but good.
Yeah.
That is out there.
You know, something that just occurred to me that, you know, to tie it back to COVID, because I think COVID's not taboo. And I have to say, and I don't want to agree with Trump at all, but like, I think people are so, so saturated, so sick of it. Doesn't mean we shouldn't listen and learn and read. Very closely linked to that is death. I think we as Americans in particular suck at talking about death. You know, how many consults do you get, Kaveh, who are 90 and 100 and 80 who have terrible, terrible illness. And then we're still talking about people call us to do procedures. And, you know, I think that's something that I would love to hear if you have a perspective, or have you write the next book on, because
we're terrible. Ideas for you here.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I absolutely agree with you. The other taboo I just thought of the taboo. Nobody wants to talk about old people. Nobody wants to be an old person, but nobody wants to talk about it. And and I don't mean like how to not get old, but just to talk about the things that happen to the human body as you age. You know, I'm starting to experience some of that stuff, and I'm like, what's going on? What is that? You know, it just isn't. And nobody wants to talk about nursing homes, which, you know, there's just got to be a better system for helping people with dealing with dementia and old age and decrepitude. I think we just want to not look at it. We don't want to look at it. I was joking with my editor one time about I should do a book called Geezer, which would be about not like how not to age, but just what the heck is going on with all your body parts.
You know,
as you get really old.
I would love to read that book, but I don't want you to write it because I just don't think it'll sell, because I think you guys are totally spot on, because nobody wants to talk about it. And Lizzie's right. Like, we patients will come, or, you know, Lizzie and I will be in the hospital taking care of someone who's very old and very ill, and we'll be talking to the family, and the family will clearly, you know, be addressing these subjects of death, mortality, how the patient wants to be treated, how aggressive they want to be, what kind of things they're willing to put up with and do. They're clearly dealing with it for the first time. You know, maybe they've thought about it in the back of their mind, but they've never verbalized it. They never talked about it amongst themselves as a family. And people just don't want to. They don't want, and I understand
why. It's always too late.
I know. And every person, it's almost like reinventing the wheel. There's no handbook. There's no people. It's like each person, their parents get old, and all of a sudden they're like, what do I do? What are the options here? What should I do? Can I afford that? There's no good options. When I told my editor I was thinking about it, she goes, Mary, please don't write a book about old people.
See? But won't every old person buy it? Is it? What do you mean it won't sell? They won't buy it?
They're going to be like watching, I don't know, what do old people watch these days? Fox News?
No, Wheel of Girls? I don't know what they watch.
All the girls?
No, I think it's like CSI.
Oh,
like, Detroit
Seinfeld
or something.
Reruns.
Matlock, yeah.
So
Matlock!
That's what my grandma watched.
So it's been interesting and frustrating for us to follow the news because of some of the headlines that you'll see regarding COVID. And it's always a game I play in my mind when they write a headline, like NBC News had a headline recently saying, 4 people in Oregon have tested positive for the coronavirus after receiving both doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, which is technically true. But if you keep reading the article, it says clearly that, like, you know, that their cases were very mild or asymptomatic completely. And those numbers are, compared to the general population, really great. Like, and it's hidden in the article a little bit, but I find it so frustrating that I play a little game, which is, did the editor who put that through not know that's how it's coming across and they were just kind of dumb, or was it just clickbait, which I assume is the answer 99% of the time? And it kind of drives me crazy, and I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to say that
Kaveh's just venting to you, Mary.
I totally agree, and I also feel really bad for whoever wrote that piece, because I bet you that they were horrified by the headline. Whoever wrote the piece tried to present it in a balanced way. I mean, I would prefer that's not really news. It's not in the same way that, okay, one out of umpteen million people will have a severe anaphylactic reaction. It's like, any vaccine, not news. Why? Right. It's clickbait. And it's dangerous clickbait, because I know personally, I really 5 or 6 people who are hesitant to get the vaccine, because I mean, I had to have a conversation with my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law saying, yeah, you may not feel great the next day, but yes, you should get the second shot. No, it's not going to change your DNA. Just like, mm-hmm. What are you even reading this? It's just very disheartening and frustrating that that's the information people are grabbing onto rather than there's so much good information that's encouraging people to get the vaccine because it's safe.
Right.
And let's look at this. Let's, you know, here are one side of the scale. We've got possible death and long-term consequences of COVID. And on the other side, we've got a tiny, tiny, tiny chance that you'll have to get a shot of epinephrine. I don't know.
Right. You know,
I think the clickbait argument is so complicated, right? Because what if you're a great journalist with a lot of integrity and you wrote a great article? And if you do a clickbait title, more people are going to read it. That's the pitch, right? It's like, you know, Kaveh and I have both done online dating. Like, you're going to do your pictures where you look amazing and just get the person to sort of like be interested and email you. Doesn't mean that's what you look like every day, but you know, there's a clickbait thing.
I look great in every picture. I don't know what she's talking about.
That's adorable.
The approach I had.
But the problem is most people don't go beyond the headline anymore.
Exactly. True. No one's reading. And to be honest, to be fair, I'm usually not at this point either with every headline that comes across on COVID. Yeah. I'm not reading every article anymore. That one I read because I'm like, what is this garbage? So in a way, they did get me to read it when I may not have. And I find that very frustrating.
Right, you know? Right.
Yeah, exactly.
I do think journalism, I mean, and maybe you can speak to this, Mary, but is at a crossroads, you know, about all this misinformation and publications that are not vetted. You know, you said before you read an article or read a nonfiction book, you like to know who the author is and what their background is. And this is a crossroads, not just for journalism, but America and the world. And, you know, just learning how to vet. And I think that's the biggest important part of like education now for kids is like learning what, you know, where to get your truth from. And this is like a huge obstacle right now in the world. So it's interesting and terrifying.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm a journalist, a writer. I mean, I know how to navigate the system and I have a good sense of what I can trust and what I can't, but That's not true for most people. I don't know, they may get their news. A lot of people get their information from Facebook and from things other people are reposting. And you have to constantly go, well, wait a minute, where's this coming from? I mean, my husband has a cousin who's constantly posting this crazy, you know, she sees it on the internet and then she emails it to everybody on her list and it's just crazy stuff. And my husband and I are like, she's so tired of us because we'll go, if you go on Snopes, here's the link, you'll see, in fact, this is not true. And she'll go, yeah, but it's entertaining.
Well, at least that's good. At least she's honest. She's like, I'm only into this because it's a salacious story. Yeah. That's it. Okay, so we have listener questions for you. And usually I only do a couple, but some of these are really good. So let's just start. ENVMKTS. Boy, come on, man. That is not catchy at all. Can you work on that name, please?
Maybe it looks cool.
Three questions for Mary Roach. Okay. We may not have to go through all three, but let's do at least this one. What advice would you have given to your 18-year-old self?
Back off on the eyeliner.
Goth, you had a little gothy sort of thing going on?
Just, you know, not well executed.
Nice. Okay. Is this how you figured it would turn out, what you're doing now, I assume?
I had no idea. I'm like, I don't know. I went to college. I'll find a job. I don't know, a liberal arts degree. Well, I'm not suited for anything really, but well, I guess I can put words together. So, I mean, I started out as a copy editor. I mean, it's not at all how I had no idea how it would turn out, but I certainly wasn't planning or foreseeing this.
And the last part of this three-part question is what's next?
Oh, I have a book coming out in September and I'll be announcing it in early April with much hoopla. Yeah.
But I assume you can't tell us much about it now, huh?
That's correct.
Okay, I won't push you on it. Let's see. I got some more questions here. People want to know when you're going to do another space book. Here we go. This question is from Brandita at Brandita 1973. What's your favorite internal organ? If reincarnation is real, what do you want to return as? And what's the grossest body ailment you've personally had? Got real personal at the end there.
These are the best questions. Okay. I can answer all these three. Okay. What's my favorite internal organ? That was the first one.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not which organ do I want to be reincarnated as?
No. No.
I like both those questions. Please, yeah. Please answer.
Okay. I would, if I were going to be reincarnated as an organ, I would not want to be, a heart is too much responsibility.
Yeah.
And it's too much exercise. I think I would probably go for the spleen because it seems, first of all, it's cool to say.
Mm-hmm. I'm the spleen. But nobody wants to take care of the spleen. The spleen is the, you know, the orphan organ. Nobody wants to claim it. No one in medicine.
Can't even describe. I think my boyfriend asked, like, what is a spleen? And I'm like, I don't know how to really explain it that well. So
the bag of blood in your body.
Bag of stuff.
It helps sometimes with immune stuff, sometimes not.
Immune stuff.
So
the liver. I like the liver. It's very aerodynamic. It's really boss looking.
It's the sweet, noblest of all the organs. It's very industrious.
I mean,
and it regrows on its own, right?
Well, I was going to say, if you're going to do reincarnation, I think the liver is probably the most appropriate.
I don't think they meant if you're reincarnated, what organ? Like, I think who?
Yeah, I know.
Or like what kind of person you want.
Yeah. Or what? Yeah. Who or what? I think what it said. Yeah.
Right. Right.
I kind of like to come back as a flying squirrel. Because I was just looking at pictures of flying squirrels yesterday. Somebody had tweeted this amazing picture. See, I wouldn't want to be a bird because I want to be able to use my hands. I can't imagine anything more frustrating than using your head to pick things up. But I think it'd be kind of cool to have this option to, like, you know, spread out your whatever membrane and fly around. So I'm going to go with flying squirrel.
Yeah, I like that too. Something that flies, just to change it up a little bit.
Exactly.
You don't have to answer what is the grossest personal body ailment you've ever had.
I'm trying to think of a gross one, and it would be really appropriate for me to have had some really gross things. But
I had a weird infected ear cyst that I think I posted last a year ago. Nice. It was pretty dope. Really nasty.
Pretty crusty.
Yeah, it was gross. I had a
crusty thing in here. Yeah.
Ear. Super gross. Two years ago now. Jeez, March 2019,
man. Okay, I got another one. This is from Diamond at Diamond, and then there's a lot of numbers. What did Mary Roach have to edit out of her books for length, or because it didn't quite fit the narrative that she really loved and wanted to include? This is a good question.
Okay.
Was it the part about Lizzie's weird ear thing? Just kidding.
Yeah, that'll be my next book.
Yeah, right.
There was a story for... it was Bonk. I was in Egypt, and which is a book about the study of sexual physiology and how kind of awkward that is. And, you know, some of it was historical and some was current. And there's this physician in Egypt, Ahmed Shafiq. Well, he's passed on by now. But anyway, I was visiting him because he said he like studies these reflexes of sexual intercourse. I'm like, whoa, that'd be interesting. Can you show me any of these reflexes? And he's like, yeah, I can. So I'm like, this is going to be great. So I go to visit Ahmed Shafiq, and I get there and he says, I said, so we were going to have a demonstration somehow. And he goes, yes, I had someone lined up, but she's not here. She's left. I don't know where she's went, but I have someone else. And he brought this guy in and he had him like stand up on the examining table and he demonstrated and he took out a pointer and he demonstrated, and you guys will know what this is, the anal wink. So this poor guy's like drops his scrubs and like Ahmed Shafiq takes his pointer and he's like in here and he does this little scratch thing and, you know, the anus winks. And I'm like, oh my God, I have to put this in the book. And I do, I put it in the book, the whole scene. Plus the fact that looking at this guy, you know, watching this reminded me, I flashed on those Easter eggs as a kid where you look through the little hole into the little candy egg and you see in the little scene inside with the bunny rabbits. And I wrote this whole thing up and my editor just wrote one word, no.
That's so interesting.
The guy was in scrubs. Was this like a medical student? That would be so tragic.
It probably was a medical student. And later in the day when I was leaving, I passed him in the hallway and like he would not look me in the eye. I'm like,
oh my God. He should have given you the eyeball wink. That would have been apropos to the anal wink. That's so interesting that Ahmed Shafiq was like, I'm sorry, the student we had is not here. I have to find someone else. Cause like everybody has the anal wink. It's like a reflex. It's instinctive.
Yeah.
So like you don't need to find the special diamond in the rough.
What he found was the one kid who needed that extra credit really bad.
Right. No, totally. Totally. I understand why you wouldn't want to perform the anal wink.
Right.
But he made it sound, the way you're pitching it, he made it sound like it was a unique demonstration that he needed to find the perfect specimen.
He was just like, excuse me, I need to find any warm human being out in the hallway that isn't me.
Whoever will show me your asshole, please come here.
Step this way.
All right, one last question for you. This comes from Kirsten R., and this is in regard to your book, Stiff, The Curious Life of Cadavers. So the question is, after doing all the research you've done, doing all the studying you've done, which way would you choose to go once you die? Cremation or burial, etc.?
Yeah, well, I feel that, you know what's interesting right here? Do you see this? This is the papers to donate to UCSF.
Wow.
Yeah. Haven't signed them yet, but I have them.
That makes the most sense.
Wait, how did you get them?
Donate your body to science.
Did you request them or did you?
Yeah, I requested them because I'm doing an update to Stiff, like an epilogue basically, and following up. And the book talks about the ending. I talk about what I might do or not do. And so I figured I should update that by saying that I'm filling out the papers to donate my remains to UCSF. So
that's cool.
And really, if you write the book Stiff, you kind of have to do that, right?
Yeah, you have no choice. Yeah.
I have to say, like, that was really special to me. And I'm a clown and I'm a joker, but when I was in, you know, medical school and doing anatomy and we're working with that body, that was nothing but respect for that person who decided to let us do that. Yeah. And I mean, that's stayed with me and it will for the rest of my life. So it was really huge.
I think the professors of the anatomy class are very, for me as well, were very clear about what a privilege and what an honor it was for us to be able to do that on a cadaver and how gracious somebody would have been to do that.
Yeah, like they do a memorial ceremony afterwards at UCSF. A lot of schools will do where the students read things they've written. And obviously they don't have any remains there at the memorial, but they, it's, and I went to one for the book and it was very moving. Would you guys do that having been through it on the other side?
That's fun. I haven't actually concretely thought about it. I always thought about cremation because being buried in a cemetery seems like a ridiculous use of land. Mm-hmm. And it's like a finite space. And once it's all filled, someone's just going to like put a building there, you know, like it loses its value at some point. So cremation always made more sense to me, but donating my body to science is probably, I did think about it many years ago, but it hasn't actually come back to my mind until this conversation. So it totally makes sense.
I'll have to think about it. I'm torn between that or cremating myself and making everyone drink me as a tea, which I'm leaning towards right now.
Okay. Yeah, I'll consider that.
A lot of options for the cremains. There was some that I came across when I was writing Stiff. There was a sex worker who had a dildo made for her partner with her cremains in the plastic.
Oh, wow.
I know. I thought, wow, that's really creative.
That's really sweet in a really interesting way.
Really weird way. Yeah.
Really,
now I have more to think about.
Anyways,
so many options.
It's like, it's super like, do I donate my body to science or do I make myself into a dildo? This is like, these are the questions that we want our listeners to think about. And I appreciate your time, Mary Roach, for making me think about this as well.
Thank you so much, Mary. Thank you for your time. We really appreciate you coming on the show. Can you just tell people where they can find you if they haven't already?
My books, do you mean?
Yes. And Twitter too, wherever you want.
Oh yeah. Well, the books are anywhere you find books, you know, Amazon, Powell's, wherever you're going to buy a book. I'm on Twitter at Mary_Roach.
Very good. And we'll put links up, obviously, to all those things. Yep. Mary, thank you so much for coming on. Always a blast to talk to you.
Oh, it's so great. Thanks, you guys, for having me on. I always enjoy it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
The Persians didn't invent ice cream sandwiches?
Listen, I'm surprised, too. I mean, look, if I went back far enough, we probably would figure it out that they did.
We probably would. We probably would. Okay.
All right. But it would be like a weird flavor. It'd be like pistachio flavor.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive.